Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode of After Dark contains discussion of cannibalism.
Hello and welcome to After Dark. I, as usual, am Anthony.
And I'm Maddie.
And today we don't know what we're doing. Well, we do. But we have something at the top of this episode that we are going into blind, just like you guys. We have a message from one of our listeners. And this listener is Muriel Buick. And she has sent us in a story, which we are about to listen to for the first time right now with you guys. So get comfy and let's listen to Muriel's story.
Hello, my name's Muriel Buick. I live in Fife in Scotland, but I'm originally from slightly further north. I was brought up on a farm in the county of Angus, and it's about 9 miles to the northeast of Dundee. The name of the farm was called Den Fynd, which I remember being told at a very young age meant Den of the Fiend or Den of the Devil. And it's just something I accepted and never thought any more about. I can't honestly remember when I heard the story about cannibalism. The story is based in a deep ravine which separates the farm that I grew up on, i.e. Den Fynd, and the farm that borders to the south, which is called Paterley. And in between these two farms, there is like a den or a ravine, if you like, and there's a wee sort of burn that flows through it. I haven't been down there for years, but I do remember going down there quite a lot with my older brother and my two elder sisters, and we used to play down there quite a lot. You know, you could walk, if you had your wellies on, you could walk down the field into the den and walk right along it. The den would come deeper and deeper, the ravine would become deeper and deeper. It was quite magical, and we used to love going down there and just sort of messing around in the burn and you know, all that stuff. The story is that basically in the reign of James II, which is 1437 to 1460, there was a guy who lived in this ravine with his whole family. And the legend goes that this chap was in the habit of, you know, if there was any travellers going through, he would grab them and eat them. And apparently, the younger they were, the more tender and delicate they tasted. So anyway, as time went on, the locals sort of got wise to this and the whole family were rounded up and burnt for the crime in Dundee. That was all except a baby girl who was a year old at the time. So they felt that she was too young to be put to death for this. And so she was saved and she ended up being given to a local family to be brought up. The story then goes that somehow when she got a bit older, she discovered that she quite liked the taste of human flesh as well. So she ended up being condemned for the same crime. Apparently on her way to be burnt, she was cursed and sworn at, and she replied, "Wherefore chide you with me as if I had committed an unnatural act? Give me credit. If you had experience of eating either of women's or men's flesh, you would never forbear it again."
Right. Right, Muriel. Firstly, that was well told. Muriel's storytelling ability, I'm here for it. That was
We're out of a job, I think.
Yeah,
thank you,
Muriel. You are now the host of After Dark. But today's episode, we did not know this going into this. Actually, I guess it makes sense. Somebody somewhere is planning these things out. Because we are talking about another Scottish cannibal story, which is from a legend that's growing and has taken on many different forms, it seems, over the time. And that is the tale of cannibalism, and not just cannibalism, but also incest, apparently, the tale of Sawney Bean.
So I came across this on, our guest today, Kat's Instagram stories, I think it was. And it's interesting because I think it has a life of its own at the moment on TikTok, on Instagram. This story is almost, okay, it's set in the, what, the 16th century, but it's taken on a life of its own, hasn't it?
It absolutely has. And also, the fact that Muriel is from Fife and I'm also from Fife, maybe this is what drew me.
You're actually from actual Fife?
I am from actual Fife.
I hate
my accent is going to get stronger as this episode goes on, as we talk about it. But yeah, I grew up knowing this story. Again, I don't know why, but this was always a story that I knew.
Those of you who don't know, Kat is joining us again because she joined us on one of our favourite episodes, which was the Paris Morgue episode. She's a historian of the Paris Morgue, the New York Morgue, and she is also a photographer and food writer. But today, food writer.
Oh, yes.
Today we were talking about a very specific delicacy, and that is human flesh. Kat, you mentioned that you grew up knowing some of these details from living in Fife. What exactly were the parts of the legend that you were familiar with?
I actually remember going to the Edinburgh Dungeons when I was very young. I don't know if you've been to any of the dungeons.
I haven't, actually.
No, I don't think I've ever been.
They're pretty intense. And Sawney Bean is one of the main features of the Edinburgh one. So I remember going as a kid and that being a very formative memory because it was terrifying. And you go on this little boat and it takes you into this cave and then there's the whole Sawney Bean tale is there. So yeah, I think it's a story that I'd always heard. And I think it's quite well known in Scotland.
I'd never heard of it.
Not so much outside of
it. No, no.
It's definitely not known in England. Yeah. Or certainly
Had you ever heard of it?
Speaking for every English person ever, I've never heard of it. No, right. Never ever heard of it until Kat's story. So we should specify that it is really a legend, isn't it? That there's not a huge amount, potentially, of historical evidence for this story. But there are certain details that put it in a place and a time with individuals, right? So who are the main players and when is this taking place?
So there's a couple of versions of this story. The most common one is set in the 16th century, so kind of the mid-1500s. Mm-hmm. And it starts with a man called Alexander Bean, whose nickname is Sawney. So he's known as Sawney Bean. And he is from a labouring family. So I think it's ditch diggers or farm workers. It's always, as the tales go, it's always people who are kind of working in the land. And in the most popular version, it's set in East Lothian. Sometimes it's set in Ayrshire. So Sawney supposedly grows up and he's quite an idle and lazy young man. And he does not want to follow his father into the ditch digging profession. Mm-hmm. And he sort of gets into scrapes and petty crime and that kind of thing. And then he meets a young woman who is also on a similar dark path, who is known as Black Agnes Douglas, because she is supposedly dabbling in witchcraft and crime and other dark pursuits.
So anyway, let's just do a recap. We have black magic, we have witchcraft, we have hints of vagrancy coming in here that they're taking themselves outside society. So there's quite a few things coming together in this.
Bit of degeneracy, bit of the kids don't want to work these days and look where this could lead them.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, it's a bit of a morality
kind of
tale.
Yeah,
you don't want to dig ditches. You don't know where you might end up.
Okay, yeah. So Sawney and Agnes,
they meet, they're in love.
They lock eyes and they realise they have things in common.
Perhaps across a market square.
Okay.
Perhaps across a ditch, we don't know. And yeah, so then they get into trouble in the town that they're in because of the crime and the black magic. And, you know, they're not popular.
The crime and the black magic.
Just standard
general
activities.
General satanic
worship. We haven't even gotten into the incest and cannibalism yet, but they're already developing a bit of a rep. And so they leave. Mm-hmm. They leave the town behind. They remove themselves from society. And they go to the coast and they find a nice cave that they think they can set up home in.
Okay. I mean, we talk so much on the show, don't we, about these kind of peripheral spaces, woodlands, caves, areas that are other in some way, that are on the edge of society, on the edge of quote-unquote civilization. Scary places in the landscape. This is screaming that to me.
Yeah, who knows what's going on in there? What are the rules? If you're living in a cave, what are the rules?
It's a lawless land. And apparently, again, according to legend, this cave was cut off by the tide twice a day.
Right.
So you can so also even more remote.
Oh yeah, you can get up to dodgy activities in a cave like that. People are probably not going to come across you.
Yes.
And they are going to get up to, I think it's fair to say, dodgy activity.
Dodgy is a word for it, for sure.
A grey wave is sweeping in from the Atlantic towards the lonely coast of Galloway. It swells, rises, then crashes down onto the beach, rushing in a rolling fury towards a cave in the cliff. It reaches the narrow entrance, dashing itself against slimy rocks, mingling with the dank air. Inside, looking back out to sea, are a family of faces. The Bean Clan in full force, more than 40 of them in all. They're finishing a meal. Too full to have another bite, one of them throws what they can't eat out the mouth of the cave. And so our wave returns to the ocean, carrying with it a partially eaten human arm.
Bleak.
Dun, dun, dun.
Horrible.
So we had Agnes and we had Sawney Bean, and now they live in a cave, as Kat said, but now they have children.
There are many beans. What's going on?
There are many beans. Yeah, so they've got their, you know, newlywed love nest cave, and Agnes has been pregnant, and they have a couple of beans. According to one legend, I think it's 8 or 10 children.
I mean, that's more than a couple.
Quite a lot. And then the Bean Clan continues, perhaps a little bit of incest encouragement there. They're not seeing a lot of other people.
Oh, this is where the incest.
This is where the incest comes in the legend. Yeah, so they're keeping it in the family in that cave. Mm. And yes, supposedly we soon have maybe like 40, 45 beans running around.
The fact that they're called beans is kind of distracting, isn't it?
It is.
Mr. Bean was not
based on
I have looked into it. I don't believe that Mr.
He's
Bean,
the one bean who made it out of the cave.
I was going to explain an awful lot if he is.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Question. Who are they eating then?
Well, so obviously, as we've heard, that Agnes and Sonia are quite idle. They don't want a regular job. And so they are robbing people. But people then, you know, might go to the authorities. So then they murder them. Mm-hmm. Then you have to get rid of the body again, you know, could count as evidence.
Okay.
So they decide to just start eating.
Well, the thing is, they're not doing any of it, right? Because none of it's true. And that's the, well, Kat, tell me, like, why are we left with these stories if they don't seem to serve, well, they serve a purpose in that what you were saying is, okay, don't leave society, don't cut yourselves off. You have to be part of this greater good. So mm-hmm. it serves that purpose. But then we get into cannibalism and incest. So what purpose is that serving? Why are we left with these stories? Where is that coming from?
What I think is really interesting is, like we had from Muriel at the beginning, there are various versions of this story, like you say, and they do often involve cannibalism, sometimes incest, often murder as well. So you've got these multiple taboos going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of cannibal stories, I guess from this kind of period or from later, maybe into the 17th, 18th, 19th century, are about otherness.
Mm-hmm.
So they're about kind of portraying other people as savage or uncivilized or outside of the boundaries of society and anti-establishment in that way. So we can perhaps see this as a kind of anti-Scottish sentiment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the people that were originally spreading this story, according to the sources that we do have, the story begins to appear in, I think it's, you know, the late 18th century
mm-hmm.
in English chapbooks.
Yeah, it starts to appear in print, doesn't it? So people are reading this. And of course, you know, think of the 18th century and England's relationship to Scotland. We've got the Acts of Union, but it's a very troubled relationship. There's lots of tension. And of course, in the earliest decades into the 1740s, we've got the Jacobite Risings, of course, and a Scottish, predominantly Scottish army coming down all the way to Derby before it turns back and is eventually defeated. But, you know, there's huge tension and there's fear about, from an English perspective, of people across the border. They are othered. And you can totally see that, you know, they're being represented as quote unquote uncivilized, you know, that they are othered. They are monsters, really.
Yeah.
Deviant in that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's also an implication then with all of that in mind. I think the 18th century, as Maddie and I would often say, is key to most things.
But it is the answer to everything.
Yeah. The idea that the beans have been committing incest and therefore procreating within this cave in the 16th century, right? So by the time we get to the 18th century, how many of them are there? And what are the implications that that's saying for Scotland? Basically, it's saying that this whole group of people are savages, they partake in incest, they eat humans, that is what we are left with.
And that they're multiplying.
And that they're multiplying. Yeah, and that's what the population is, not what it actually was.
Yeah. And that they're very inbred.
Yeah.
There's really an implication in that.
We come back to this again and again, don't we? What's going on that we do not know?
Yeah. Isn't and taboo.
Yes.
Really, I think this is the thing, like incest and cannibalism, they're really up there with the ultimate taboos. So if you want to make a great, memorable legend that really encapsulates this idea of people being absolutely savage and, as you say, uncivilized.
And couple that with the Scottish landscape itself, which is this wild thing. It's this, again, especially from an English perspective, it's this unconquerable thing going up, you know, the British army going to the Highlands to try and deal with the Highlanders, clearing the land eventually. There's a sense of not having easy control and access to those people, not being able to understand it and work with it, that these stories kind of come from. It's interesting to me, though, that the places where this story or versions of the story survive are still Scottish.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's something, like you say, of Scotland as this idea of it being rugged and wild and untamable that we still think of today. Scotland absolutely thrives on dark tourism and really kind of capitalizes on its very dark history, think to do with witches, Burke and Hare.
Yep.
Yeah.
All these kind of things.
Battlefields,
yeah. All of that, this real sort of haunted landscape where, you know, the blood has seeped into the ground and, you know, reverberations through centuries, and that kind of idea is really part of, I would say, the Scottish psyche. I think, I mean, I grew up with stories like this. Maybe that's also just says something about my family. But, you know, this is very much part of Scottish culture and Scottish tourism. And I think as well that Scotland loves a folk hero and a folk anti-hero.
Sure.
The English version that's told in the 18th century story is very anti-Scottish, but Scottish people themselves have actually turned that around and made it to their advantage. It's really fascinating.
But also that what you were talking about earlier, Maddie, about this idea that, from an English perspective, if the Scots are savages, then they need to be tamed and controlled. And therefore, what can we do? I say this as an Irish person. The Commons are going to pop up. What can we do but go up and take what we need, because they just don't know what they're doing with it? And we see it again and again in that colonial narrative.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the core of so much colonial and imperialistic narrative, isn't it? Is that they need us.
Yes.
So actually, we have to go for the sake of civilization.
Yeah, yep. we have to go and help them.
Exactly. Yeah. We must go and tame them, mm-hmm. and, you know, bring them to our civilized ways that involve not eating each other.
So a lot of this discourse, though, is coming in the later centuries, but the story itself is taking place in the 16th century, in the 1500s. We've got these beans running around the landscape, attacking people, eating them, or taking them back to the cave and eating them. They're going to get caught, presumably, because we know about this story, whether or not it's true. Presumably, we wouldn't know about it if everyone that they attacked died and their remains were destroyed. So there must be a survivor.
Yeah. So like you say, if it just, you know, continued happily with the cannibalism forever, we might never have known of the legend. But instead, unfortunately, at some point it was bound to go wrong. Mm-hmm.
Well, as cannibalism goes.
Cannibalism goes. You can only
don't try it at home.
Yeah. You can only do it for so long. But again, according to legend, they had a good go of it, about 25 years of cannibal activity.
And no one noticed during this time?
Well, supposedly people did notice, because they ate around 1,000 people.
Wow.
Goes the standard statistic. Although I also did...
I'm not buying that.
No, because also I did...
Wait, how many people would you need to... eat over 25 years? You could eat 1,000 people.
So I worked this out yesterday.
But people
I did work this out yesterday in advance. I think it's about 40 people a year, which also isn't enough for a family of
40 people a year?
50. Yeah.
How many people is that? Okay, wait. So 40
cannibal maths.
Yeah. So a family of what, 40?
It's just like 40 of them.
Yeah, they're having one person a year.
Yeah, that's not enough people. So the maths doesn't work out. But then I did also see a statistic, it's a very generous term for this, that... on Wikipedia, it says 5,593 people.
Very precise.
I do not know who got this incredibly precise number.
I love the way we're trying to work this out and none of it happens.
Yeah.
Why do you bring a menu together? But then, I mean, we could get also siege diets. People did make bread out of bones once upon a time, but that's the whole, and eat all the animals in the zoo in Paris once.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about this particular history that didn't actually happen, but cannibalism does have a real... gruesome history, and you're totally right that at various points human beings have eaten each other.
Yeah,
sometimes to survive.
Sometimes for need, sometimes ritualistically. So cannibalism has existed. There's evidence of cannibalism going back to the prehistoric period. People are always going to eat people.
And if they don't, they're going to have stories about them eating 5,993 or whatever it was people that in a cave in Scotland somewhere. Yeah. This is what I often find. I often find that the actual stories or the myths that we explore in After Dark are way less scary than actually what's happening. And if you put it in the context of the 18th century again, and you are a Scottish person living on the Highlands and the clearances are coming, that's going to be petrifying. That is going to be potentially the most scary thing you are going to encounter in your life. And then the fear and the just degradation, the inhumane treatment that you're going to experience afterwards once you're displaced, then that's the kernel of the fear, as opposed to this cannibal that doesn't exist in a cave somewhere, right? But it is fascinating that it's adopted in Scotland. Because, I mean, are we saying then that it's English in origin, this?
It's so hard to find the origin, isn't it? It certainly appears in the English print in the 18th century, but that's not to say that it didn't exist for the two centuries before in Scotland, it's not a story being handed down.
Yeah.
In which case, it totally changes the meaning of it, I think. It's so hard to know who is telling this, why they're telling it, what kind of story they're trying to tell, what's the message, what's the cannibal element about. And I totally buy, Kat, what you're saying about it being to do with a sort of colonial viewpoint and othering these people. I also think there's something, Anthony, that you said about not wanting people to go to that part of Scotland, sort of frightening people. Mm. You know, presumably a lot of the people who are disappearing are travellers, are people walking up and down the routes of Scotland along the coast. There's something there about wanting to keep strangers out. And I wonder if the story's kind of changed shape so many times that it's used for all these different kinds of political standpoints, and that it's sort of morphed into it's cannibalized itself, you might say.
And stop it.
You're welcome.
Walked into that.
But you know, it's serving lots of different people in completely different ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic bogeyman story, isn't it? And like you say, I think it could very well have operated at a local level.
Mm.
So there's so many different versions of this. Sawney Bean is the most well-known,
mm-hmm.
but there's various versions of Scottish cannibal stories like we had from Muriel at the beginning, and they date back to kind of the 1400s, 1300s mm-hmm. in terms of when the story is set. So we don't also know that this wasn't something told locally of, watch out for that road.
Yes.
There's a cannibal family, or
to
children, to tell them to not stray too
exactly.
far.
Well, exactly. I mean, what Muriel was saying, to me, the warning was initially, kids, stay out of that place.
Yeah.
That's not safe. Because it's not safe. Like, in mm-hmm. terms of the physical landscape, anything could happen in those ravines.
Yeah, and a cave that's cut off by the tide at certain points is a really seriously problematic place.
As a child. So therefore, that's what you're being told as mm-hmm. a child. But Maddie, you were talking earlier about how they're being caught and how they're being mm-hmm. discovered. And I think if we go to the next part of the story, it gives a flavour of how the myth ended, I suppose.
The disappearances of 1,000 people did not go unnoticed. Everyone knew that you walked this stretch of the Western Road of Scotland at your peril. Innocent people were accused and hanged. At last, the Beans' luck finally turned sour when they attacked a couple coming home from a fair. The woman was quickly killed. But the man proved a fierce fighter, and the Beans were still swarming him when a crowd of people from the fair appeared around the corner. The Bean clan fled into the countryside, and the news of the attack spread like wildfire all the way to King James VI of Scotland himself.
So the way this story ends... Now, it's probably worth bearing in mind that this story might end 1,000 different ways depending on who's telling it. But
because it's not real.
Because it's not real. But what we have is this idea that there were travellers on the road, which we've mm-hmm. spoken about already. They get taken in, but mm-hmm. actually they fail in their task of eating them this time. And there's an escapee. And eventually we are alerted all the way up to James, the 6th of Scotland and 1st mm-hmm. of England, which it makes total sense that James would be involved in this particular story, right?
James crops up all the time on After Dark, and we know about his demonology, we know his obsession with witches, and the fact that in the Berwick witch trials, he actually goes face-to-face to meet one of the witches, which is the most extraordinary thing for a king to do. So actually, it's no surprise to me that he's in on this supposed story.
Supposedly leading hundreds of men and bloodhounds to the Beans. By the way, I just can't cope with their surname being Beans.
Beans,
like,
I know.
You said something that the Beans were surrounded. I was like, were they?
Were they though? So hold on. You're saying that James the VI takes men and dogs and goes
this
hunting
the Beans?
This is what the legend says. Okay.
Yeah, which is just because it reminded me because you were saying about going to face to face with the witches.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not unusual that he would potentially do
putting
this.
Himself right in the
classic James.
Yeah, yeah. What else would he be doing?
We don't have records technically of James doing this.
If he went on a cannibal hunt in Scotland, surely that would be in a record somewhere.
Yes, exactly. I mean, any involvement with him and this,
he'd
would
write
be in
a book
record.
On it.
Absolutely.
We know that he likes to write about his beliefs in this kind of shadow world and the supernatural. Like 100%,
he would have written a book. 1,000 men,
mm-hmm.
even if he didn't write the book, which he would have had. But if he's taking 1,000 men, that's documented, and it ain't documented.
It ain't documented.
So therefore, problems.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it seems unlikely.
It does.
It does a little bit. You know, there is a lack of sources, but mm-hmm. as the tale goes, he took his men and the dogs and all the rest. He was led by locals to the cave.
Mm.
And obviously they found this absolute scene of carnage.
Mm-hmm.
Children in rags and blood everywhere and body parts. Real horror film tropes.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the versions has like body parts in jars and things like that.
Mm.
And then obviously stolen goods as well. So there's, you know, clothing from people and that kind of thing mm-hmm. all around. And they round up the Beans, the Bean clan, and cart them off to town,
mm-hmm.
which again varies in location. There's a legend going
yes.
In some stories
yeah.
it's Glasgow, in some stories it's Edinburgh, and put them to death.
Mm.
And the ways that they put them to death vary. whichever the most gruesome version
at the time,
whoever is telling the story, yeah. could do. So it could be that they were burnt. It could be that they had their limbs chopped off and they were mm-hmm. bled to death. It could be hung, drawn, and quartered. So mm-hmm. there's a real variety of options there. Yeah. But the consistent idea is that they died.
Yeah.
Apart from.
Oh.
As legend also goes, and this links to what Muriel was telling us at the beginning, and one version is that a daughter escaped and moved to Girvan, of all places.
Wow.
Moved to Girvan, to the seaside town, and attempted to live a quiet life, but was discovered, perhaps for continuing her cannibalistic urges, wow. or perhaps just because
they've just
she seemed a bit weird
yeah, yeah.
and she was new.
That's such a tantalizing element of this kind of story, isn't
very
it?
Filmic.
Like, yes, very cinematic. One person got away and they're still living amongst us. It's very, talking of cannibals, it's like Silence of the Lambs. Is it the end of that film or one of the Hannibal franchise films where he's like out in the world and he sort of looks back at the camera?
Yes.
Or doesn't he phone Clarice or something and he's like, I'm on a nice holiday, about to have a meal, .. hangs up. You know, it's that kind of thing, isn't it? Of like,
it's still out there.
You can never be sure that we're all safe.
Yeah,
it's the follow-up movie, isn't it? It's that's the final scene in film one.
Yeah,
setting off film two.
Talking about movies, this story has had a massive legacy in cinema, hasn't it? It's the inspiration for a few films, right?
Yeah, The Hills Have Eyes. Mm-hmm. Wes Craven said that he was inspired by the Sonny Bean tale.
Mm, but set in a different landscape, interestingly.
Yeah, so that was sort of in the sort of American desert.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I've never seen it.
It's too scary for me.
It's also actually too scary for me. I watched the trailer yesterday and it freaked me out.
Oh, I should watch this.
Mm. Yeah, it's one of the very sort of, it's a real classic horror.
Yeah.
Very dark, murder, incest.
But isn't that
More incesty stuff.
More incesty stuff, as
okay,
far
that's
as I know.
Dark,
cannibalism,
yeah.
obviously cannibalism.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, this idea of there being like a clan of cannibals.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, I see.
Yeah. And murder people.
Interesting as well, that story is transported to another remote landscape where there's questions around its wilderness
sure.
and conquering that landscape and things. That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's a good space for it. And I think also, you know, there's so many different cannibal tales that have made it into popular imagination. Mm-hmm. We think also of Sweeney Todd.
Yeah.
That's
yes.
a cannibal tale.
Yeah.
There's a lot of these. And I think it really is because it's such a taboo,
mm-hmm.
both eating someone and being eaten. Both sides
yes.
of this are very
yes,
taboo.
Yes, yes.
And I think that it makes it a perfect boogeyman story because also you could be eaten and never found again. You know, that's the whole idea as well. It's not just that you've been murdered.
Yes.
It's that you've disappeared forever and they're never going to find your body.
There are no remains.
Yeah. And that you become a kind of mutant. Some of these tales obviously mm-hmm. have that idea as well that, you know, by eating human flesh,
yes.
you become
mm-hmm.
some other version.
Yeah, which is a very early modern idea, actually, this idea of like you are what you eat. And, you know, sort of things like women breastfeeding children, if you've got a wet nurse in, obviously there were real issues around the transference of disease, but there was also worry that if you were, for example, an upper class woman who gave your child over to a lower class wet nurse, that she would transfer some of her lower class morals or intellect, supposedly, onto the child. And there was real worry about that. So it's no surprise then that, you know, we're thinking about the story in the 16th century context going into the 17th and 18th centuries, that's an issue as well, that you are corrupted literally by eating human flesh.
This is bleak. It's got incest. It's got cannibalism. What does it say that people want to hear an exploration of this story?
I think it's so outlandish and it's so taboo. And like you say, it's such a grotesque, big story. Part of the fascination is it real? And also, could humans really be pushed to that limit? I think that's the fascination,
yeah.
is people want to know, is there any evidence that this happened? Because could it happen? Could people go to that limit of like absolute, whatever you want to call it, sort of depravity to create an incestuous, cannibalistic clan?
Yeah.
There's a word that we haven't said in this episode yet, cult. They are a cult.
Oh, they are a cult.
And I think people love a cult. They're so fascinating. Understanding the psychology of how a group like that works. Obviously, in this case, they're all very much related. But, you know, how people get away with things and how people influence each other's behaviour. Because obviously, in this case, you've got Sawney and Agnes at the start of the story, starting a family. And they bring a family up into the world who eat people. It's a sort of family tradition, a family way of behaving.
It's an inheritance, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a kind of cult, I think.
It's definitely a cult, I would say. I think also one thing that's worth noting is that, you know, there's corpse medicine. So there's various, you know, and that it's a version of cannibalism.
We need to do an episode
ways.
On this.
So, I mean, it's a whole rabbit hole to go down in that, you know, especially during the sort of 15th, 16th centuries, there was a lot of medical treatments, I suppose you would call them, that relied on the body. So you had people trying to take blood from executed criminals, supposedly that cured epilepsy. Mm-hmm. You had powdered Egyptian mummies being mm-hmm. used, you know, in Europe, so being taken from Egypt and being brought to Europe and used for all sorts of different cures. It was mm-hmm. used for paint as well. So there's so much evidence and research into how yeah. bodies were used in pharmaceutical purposes mm-hmm. very early on and for quite a long period mm-hmm. and in, you know, in lots of different countries.
Yeah, interesting. So
that, you know, it's a form of cannibalism that I think as well we often don't realise.
And one that's legitimised yeah. and made okay because it's for medical purposes. Yeah. Very, very interesting. I think that's a good place to end.
I think we're done. How much more cannibalism can you take, listeners of After Dark? It has been fascinating yet again. Kat, thank you so much. We will have you back on because we have really enjoyed these conversations. If you enjoyed listening to Kat talk about her research topics, where can they find you, Kat?
At HeyMorgGirl on Instagram and Twitter. It's probably the best place.
And I will say to people, Kat's Instagram is not only fascinating for historical reasons, it's beautiful. She is a photographer. Everything is gorgeous. Yes. Follow her now.
Yes, it's so good. Listen, like us, subscribe, leave your reviews. It helps other people find us. Until then, we shall see you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of After Dark. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour.
Don't forget, you can listen to all these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe.
And as a special gift, now don't say we never give you anything, you can also get your first 3 months for £1 a month when you use the code AFTERDARK at checkout.